I am often asked if I have been abducted, to which my reply is that I simply don't know. If it has happened, it could only have been while I was asleep. However, on multiple occasions I have experienced the process commonly referred to as night paralysis, often associated with the abduction scenario, in my case accompanied by intensifying vibrations in the solar plexus. In most cases, although such episodes seem to have been engendered during sleep, they have continued after I have awoken. Whatever source causes such intrusions, I have never sensed anything benevolent about it. Termination is eventually achieved by shouting at the entity to get out, using somewhat stronger terminology. There were two occasions that made me think I might have been abducted, the second of which may be worth recounting here. In the small hours of March 27, 2006, I had been reading late in bed until 0:55. Just after falling asleep, I suddenly found myself lying on my back on the side of a country lane lined with hedgerows. I could feel the cold air. As I began to raise myself on one arm, I noticed a dark grey triangular craft with sharply defined apexes, transfixed in the dark blue sky, with numerous white lights inset along the inside of each side. I then felt vibrations intensifying in my solar plexus 17 and sensed that I was being pulled toward the craft. I resisted mentally, asking for help from who or whatever. Immediately, I found myself back in my bedroom, fully conscious. I checked the time. It was 1:05. 10 minutes had elapsed. Was I abducted? All I can say is that it felt very real. And if it wasn't an actual abduction, I can hazard a guess that it might well have been a so-called astral projection, which I have experienced previously. As a student, while dozing in bed one sunny morning, I had been taken for a low-level flight in a Royal Air Force Meteor NF Mk-11, or later Mark, jet fighter, in camouflage livery. Again, it felt very real. But, as with the more recent event, I do not believe it was physical. Which poses profound questions about the nature of abductions. While the evidence suggests that many are physical, as will have been noted in some of the preceding cases, I believe it likely that some involve abduction of the astral body, which implies a more sinister agenda. We have seen how the agenda of certain alien species involves, or has involved, the genetic engineering of numerous human beings. To what end? David M. Jacobs, PhD, a tenured associate professor of history at Temple University, Philadelphia, has made a special study of this aspect of the subject. His perspective is disturbing. For the first time in over 30 years of researching the UFO phenomenon, I am frightened of it, he writes in his book, The Threat, 1998. The abduction phenomenon is far more ominous than I had thought. Optimism is not the appropriate response to the evidence, all of which strongly suggests that the alien agenda is primarily beneficial for them and not for us. 18, Chapter 18. Special Forces. In November 1999, the Center for UFO Studies, CUFOS, received a remarkable letter from a Mrs. Lucille Andrew of Ashland, Ohio. Today, she began, I want to share some knowledge that has been, by request, kept secret in our family since sometime in World War II. This concerns something that my father was shown by Cordell Hull, who was Secretary of State under Franklin Roosevelt. Sumner Wells was his Under-Secretary of State. Hull was a cousin to my father, who was on some kind of advisory committee, and made several trips to Washington, D.C. in that capacity. My father, who was young, brilliant, and sound of mind, told this story because he didn't want the information to be lost. One day when my father was in D.C. with Cordell, Cordell swore him to secrecy and took him to a sub-basement in the U.S. Capitol building and showed him an amazing sight. 1. Four large glass jars holding four creatures unknown to my father or Cordell, and 2. A wrecked round craft of some kind nearby. My father wanted my sister and myself to make this information known long after he and Cordell were dead, because he felt it was a very important bit of information. Please don't disregard this, because what I have written is true. The jars with creatures in formaldehyde and the wrecked craft are somewhere. Cordell said they were afraid they would start a panic if the public found out about it. 1. After several telephone calls and two visits to Ashland, William Bill Jones, a director of QFOS, reports, the family became comfortable with releasing the name of Mrs. Andrews' father, the Reverend Turner Hamilton Holt, and allowing the story to be told. Here we have a tale that directly involves one of the greatest statesmen of the 20th century and a conservative man of the cloth, Bill emphasizes, who would have absolutely no apparent reason to tell a story such as this one if it weren't true, especially at a time when stories of flying saucers and their occupants had not yet become part of our culture. In an interview conducted in April 2000 by Bill Jones and Iena Scott with Mrs. Andrew and one of her sisters, Aline, who had also heard the story from her father, though too young to recall details, it was learned that Reverend Holt had described the entities in the glass jars as creatures, not aliens or extraterrestrials, as one would nowadays. They were less than 4 feet tall, and the incident is said to have occurred in the late 1930s, probably 1939. The remains of the wrecked craft were described as silver metallic. Skeptical of such remains being stored in the sub-basement of the U.S. Capitol building, Bill contacted the office of the architect of the Capitol to determine if there is or was a sub-basement in the building, at least in the late 1930s. He met with Barbara Willenin, curator of the U.S. Capitol, and related details of the story to her. She confirmed the existence of a sub-basement at that time. What if we learn that this pre-World War II alien technology wasn't retrieved in the United States but came from somewhere else in Europe or the Far East, asks Bill, transferred to the United States for protection until after the war that most people knew was coming? What if we learn that this technology was given back to France, China, or Russia after the war? How would this retransfer of technology change our view of history? 2. The U.S. Capitol report is significant, yet another to add to an ever-increasing number of such events. For example, in Need to Know I related accounts of other crashed alien vehicles predating the Roswell events, Milan, Italy, 1933, Cape Girardeau, Missouri, and Sonoran Desert, Mexico, 1941, Gdynia, Poland, 1943, Hawaii, 1944, San Antonio, New Mexico, 1945, Sweden, 1946, and Juarez, Mexico, 1947. Marina Popovich is a retired Soviet Air Force colonel, engineer, and legendary test pilot. Holding 107 aviation world records set in over 40 types of aircraft, she is widely regarded as one of the most famous pilots in Russian history. Regarding the alien subject, she has been outspoken and is the author of a book titled UFO Glasnost. She confirms that over 3,000 sightings have been reported by Soviet military and civilian pilots. She also confirms, unofficially, that the Soviet Air Force and KGB have fragments of 5 crashed UFOs in their possession. She gives the crash sites as Tunguska, the famous event in 1908, Novosibirsk, Tallinn, Estonia, Ordsonikids, Caucasus, and Alnigusk, and states that the analyzed debris revealed that it was not manufactured on Earth with terrestrial technology. 3. RAND. The RAND, Research and Development, Corporation is a non-profit global policy think tank, initially established in 1946 by the U.S. Army Air Forces as Project RAND, under contract to the Douglas Aircraft Company. It is currently financed by the U.S. government, various corporations, and private endowment. In 1969, a researcher requested a copy of a certain document on UFOs. RAND has done very little research on the subject, came the reply, therefore, no publications have been written. A similar request from another researcher was met with a rather different response: we are unable to identify any RAND publications on UFOs available for external distribution. In March 1970, the actual RAND document was requested by number and title, UFOs, What to Do? RAND responded that, as an internal document, it was not releasable. But eventually it leaked out, As researchers C. E. Free and Earl J. Neff reported, the document was not to be quoted in any publication or company correspondence. Inquiries by ufologists, NASA personnel, and interested citizens all received a courteous refusal to share the information contained in this study, they note. 4. In retrospect, it is difficult to understand why. Could the reasons for such reluctance simply stem from the fact that the author, George Kocher, gives an unbiased and intelligent overview of the subject, which could have been interpreted as an acknowledgement of the realities involved? Or, perhaps more likely, that the corporation simply feared internal and external ridicule? In any event, the document, originally published in November 1968, is currently available online from RAND. This paper was originally produced as an internal document. It was not prepared for or delivered to any of RAND's clients, a short added preface emphasizes. Peer review has not been undertaken, nor has it been edited or prepared for publication. It is being released at this time as a matter of public interest. Henry Kissinger and the Office of Special Studies. In his groundbreaking book UFO Crash at Aztec, Californian researcher William Steenman covers for the first time some related information about Dr. Eric Henry Wang, who seems to have been a crucial link in the study of crashed alien vehicles. Raymond Fowler, another first-class researcher with whom I have also previously communicated extensively, was the first to reveal that Dr. Wang headed the Office of Special Studies at Wright Air Development Center, Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, Dayton, Ohio. That office dealt largely with recovered alien craft and their crews, such as an incident near Kingman, Arizona, in May 1953, involving a number of witnesses, including Fritz Werner, the pseudonym for Arthur Stanzel, part of whose impressive resume I published in a previous book. Stanzel held a number of engineering and management positions at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base from 1949 to 1960. During which period he worked in the Office of Special Studies. 5. I personally checked out his resume by calling former employers during a careful character check, wrote Fowler in 1976. Neither of the two former Blue Book officers with whom I talked would confirm the Kingman incident. One asked, "Where is the object now?" The other became nervous when I mentioned Dr. Eric Wang's Office of Special Studies and asked me to leave him alone as he wanted to live out his life in privacy. 6. The work that Dr. Wang was involved in was so classified that there were no more levels of secrecy left above that, asserts Steenman. Born in Vienna in 1906, Wang taught engineering at the University of Cincinnati before working on government projects at the Wright Air Development Center from 1949 until 1956, when the department was transferred to the Sandia Laboratories complex at Kirtland Air Force Base, New Mexico. He died in 1960, aged 54. A telephone interview by Bill Steenman with Wang's widow, Maria, Steenman does not give her name in his book, is revealing. W.S., I wrote a letter to you on the 23rd March in regards to Dr. Eric Henry Wang and his work involving analyses on recovered flying saucers, and the attempted duplication of them. M.W., yes, I do remember the letter, but I no longer have it, and turned it over to the authorities, military intelligence at Kirtland Air Force Base. W.S., can you tell me something about Dr. Wang's involvement in the flying saucer project? M.W., how did you know that Dr. Wang was involved in that kind of work? Why do you want to know about that? Who are you? How do I know that I can trust you? W.S., I am a freelance private investigator. I want to know the truth pertaining to the flying saucer project. I believe that the entire scientific community, the public, and mankind in general could greatly benefit from it. M.W., how can I help you? Dr. Wang's papers were all confiscated by military intelligence when he died. His notes were written in his own unique version of German scientific shorthand. Those papers were placed behind lock and key within a special sealed-off section of a highly secret section of the library at Kirtland Air Force Base. W.S., can you please describe exactly what kind of work Dr. Wang was doing on the saucers? M.W., I can't tell you over the phone. I don't know you at all, And besides, the entire subject is classified above top secret. W.S., were the saucers made on Earth? And if so, were they of German technology? M.W., no. To both questions, the person you should write to in government is Dr. H.A.K. Henry Kissinger. He is deeply involved in the flying saucer program. In fact, he was completely in charge of it at the time that Dr. Wang was still alive and involved in it. Within 2 days of talking with Maria about Dr. Wang, Steenman reports, I received a call from a well-known ufologist. He said, what did you discuss with M.W.? I understand that you discuss the library at Kirtland Air Force Base. I asked, how did you know about any of this? He said that he had his intelligence connections, and that I was now being watched very closely. 7. The reference to Dr. Henry Kissinger is significant. From 1943 to 1946, he had served in the U.S. Army Counterintelligence Corps, CIC, and from 1946 to 1949 as a captain in the Military Intelligence Reserve. 8. In some previous books, I have alluded to the Army's Interplanetary Phenomenon Unit, IPU, of the Scientific and Technical Branch, Counterintelligence Directorate, an elite investigation group reportedly set up by General George C. Marshall in 1947 to deal with the then burgeoning reports of flying discs. The existence of the IPU was confirmed for me in 1987 by Colonel Anthony J. Gallo, Jr., General Staff, Director of Counterintelligence. Please be advised, he added, that the aforementioned Army unit was disestablished during the late 1950s and never reactivated. All records pertaining to this unit were turned over to the U.S. Air Force, Office of Special Investigations, in conjunction with Operation Blue Book. 9. General Douglas MacArthur is also believed to have been involved with the IPU. During a meeting with Merkel of Naples in New York in 1955, MacArthur is reported as having stated his belief that all the countries on Earth will have to unite to survive and to make a common front against attack by people from other planets. 10. Kissinger served, in 1952, as a consultant to the Psychological Strategy Board, a covert arm of the National Security Council established in 1951, comprising the Undersecretary of State, the Deputy Secretary of Defense, and the Director of Central Intelligence. He also acted as a consultant on the Operations Coordination Board. Thus, in that period he would have had access to the most sensitive intelligence on the alien problem. Later, he became a consultant for a number of other organizations, including the RAND Corporation, the National Security Council, and the Council on Foreign Relations, and he served as director of the Special Studies Project for the Rockefeller Brothers Fund. By 1973 he had become Secretary of State, continuing to hold the position of Assistant to the President on National Security Affairs. He is also a holder of the Nobel Peace Prize. 11. L. Fletcher Putty, a former U.S. Air Force colonel who spent his last 9 years of service in the Pentagon as the official focal point officer, first for the USAF and then for the entire Defense Department with the CIA, Clandestine Operations, makes reference in one of his books to the power held by Kissinger, describing him as the titular head of the intelligence community's clandestine operations reaction faction, as he wrote in The Secret Team, 1973. His appearance as a one-man power center is simply due to the fact that he fronts for The Secret Team, discussed later, and the secret intelligence community. 12. I surmise that Kissinger retains a close association with the alien situation to this day, even at the age of almost 90. Military indoctrination. In 2008, an unusual report appeared in a British newspaper in response to an article on UFOs. The township of Roswell was the scene of probably the most famous alien encounter in history, wrote retired British Army veteran Harold Varnam. While serving on a NATO attachment to the U.S. 5th Army, we were shown classified film taken at the time of the Roswell crash that purported to show that one of the alien creatures survived the impact and lived for several hours afterwards. Varnam went on to mention, somewhat cynically, Roswell's current popularity and its annual festival. 13. Determined to learn more, I contacted him. I am not absolutely sure of the date when we saw this film, but I do remember that it was around the time of the Cuban Missile Crisis, and the place was the huge air base at Karlsruhe, Germany, he replied. The gigantic Karlsruhe base had all the usual luxuries, including a full-scale plush cinema which not only showed the latest Hollywood releases but doubled up as a lecture theater for the showing of training films. The Americans were exceptionally keen on these films, and it was not unusual for us to see anything up to half a dozen or so during our visit. So when we settled down in the cinema, we were not expecting to see anything extraordinary. As it's almost 50 years ago, I will try to recall as best I can what we were actually shown. Strangely enough, we were not briefed in advance, and the film itself was unusual in that it was not preceded by the over-the-top rhetoric that usually introduced these training films. There was only a sparse commentary, but what was surprising was that the first part of the film was in color, not the garish Technicolor version, but a kind of subdued soft-focused look. The opening scenes were of the New Mexico desert and what was obviously the crash site. It was plainly obvious that the movie was an amateur affair, probably shot by a local, and several people appeared in it holding up what looked like pieces of metal and grinning at the camera. The wreckage was apparently spread over a vast area and was reduced to just small pieces, nothing resembling an aircraft, and whatever had impacted there must have done so at colossal speed and force. It was obvious that this footage had been shot before the area had been secured. This part of the film had no commentary at all. Then there were scenes of the wreckage being taken away by the military and mention of a secure airbase somewhere which was only identified by a number. Then surprisingly the film reverted to black and white and became much slicker and professional. The scenes at the airbase showed the unloading of the recovered material, and only then did the commentary mention strange creatures found with the wreckage and the startling admission that one of them was still alive. Whatever that meant. There were shots of military ambulances and something being offloaded onto wheeled stretchers. Then the scene switched to what looked like a hospital operating theater. I must explain that this section of the film was scratched and grainy, as if it had been shown many times, as it probably had. The camera shots were angled so that you didn't really get a clear shot of the alien body, but there was just one brief moment when it came into focus. The tiny creature was obviously mangled badly, but I can only describe it as being like those aliens shown in sci-fi movies, with an oversized head and small body and limbs. Once again, the commentary was sparse and there was no attempt to explain or tell what happened to the alien. I would estimate that the entire film did not last more than 15 minutes or so. But then at the very end it reverted to type, and there was some blurb about being constantly vigilant and keep watching the skies, etc. Naturally the British lads reviewed all of these films with a healthy skepticism and their usual brand of deprecating humor. I don't remember anybody at the time being particularly impressed, as we all considered the Americans to be guilty of over-nervousness bordering on paranoia about their attitude to the Soviet threat. This was, after all, the height of the Cold War, with the hysteria that was prevalent at that period in our history. 14. According to a military officer stationed at the U.S. Army Reserve Base at Fort Allen, Juana Díaz, Puerto Rico, in 1990, following a period involving an alarming increase of alien activity on the island, including the capture of U.S. Navy F-14 Tomcat jets, a video film was shown to the men as part of an indoctrination. They showed us an old black and white film about a UFO crash that supposedly happened in New Mexico many years ago, the officer related to investigator Jorge Martin. We all saw the craft, which was semi-buried in the ground at a 45-degree angle, and there were several bodies of the crew. According to what we were shown, these bodies were about 5 feet tall, thin, very pale, and had large bald heads. They had big round eyes and a small nose, but I don't recall any mouths or ears. They also showed us another video of UFOs filmed by them around the island. They wanted us to know that UFOs are real, but they wouldn't elaborate when asked for details. It seemed to me that they wanted us to know this was real and that the beings were not perfect, they are fallible, their crafts crash, and they also die, they are not invulnerable. Apparently, They wanted to condition us to the idea that they exist, and to accept the possibility of someday having to liaise with them. 15. Survivors. At the time of writing, the most recent report relating to the New Mexico incidents was sent to me by the American researcher Ted Olift, a former police officer. He had acquired the information from a confidential source whose father had developed the film of the Roswell incident. The whole thing was documented, Ted revealed. He was in the service, then went to work for Uncle Sugar as a civilian. He said there was one surviving creature. Everything went to Wright Patterson AFB. He also said many of those involved in the retrieval later died of cancer. 16. I just learned this today. I'd known him for years, but this is the first time it ever came up in conversation. Nathan Twining Jr., the son of General Twining, commanding general of Air Materiel Command at the time, says that years later, his dad told him that he'd seen the survivor himself, and that they communicated telepathically. 17. There are remarkable parallels in this report with another, which I first learned of in 1995 from Sir Mark Thompson, a friend who had served as a jet pilot with the Royal Navy's Fleet Air Arm, then holding top secret atomic clearance. He related to me that during a flight on an airliner in the United States in 1995 he had met a lady, Linda Pichersky, who asserted that her father, Robert R. Largent, a former U.S. Army Air Corps flying instructor, had spoken with a fellow officer who claimed to have cared for the only living, remaining being who had survived the Roswell incident. Sir Mark shortly thereafter interviewed Largent by telephone and provided me with the following report. This elderly man had been a B-29 pilot, during the war. As his squadron had nuclear capability, he had a very high security clearance. Since his retirement, as a major in the reserves, his civilian job had involved a high amount of commercial flying. On one of these trips in the 1960s, Robert happened to sit next to a man who was a colonel in the Air Force, and their conversation centered on Air Force and flying matters. After Robert had explained his previous very high security clearance, he asked the colonel what he was presently doing. He told Robert that he had been looking after an alien from the past 2.5 years at a base, presumably U.S. Air Force, near Dayton, Ohio. He went on to say that they had had the most terrible time feeding the alien. They had tried everything, but nothing satisfied his nutrition and dietary requirements, and as a result of this he had recently died. The colonel went on to say that he so cared for the alien that when he died, he nearly cried. He did not give Robert his name and continually stressed that if he ever disclosed this to anyone, he would be in the gravest difficulty. At this point in our conversation, I asked Robert various questions. Why did Robert think a complete stranger, a U.S. Air Force colonel, chose to reveal this great secret to him? He replied that firstly they shared a great bond, both being pilots. I can certainly confirm this unique, strong bond between military pilots all over the world. It was clear to Robert that the alien had recently died and the colonel really wanted to talk to somebody about his grief and feelings of loss, and that Robert's high security clearance made him comfortable in discussing it. This is the total of Robert's knowledge from this chance meeting with the colonel, Mark concluded. Of course, I am not to know whether the colonel told Robert other things that Robert is declining to tell me, but I certainly got no indication of this. Robert struck me as an extremely sincere and intelligent older man. 18. Both men felt that their lives were threatened if they revealed what they knew. In 2005, Robert's daughter Linda contacted me, reminding me that, coincidentally, we had met briefly at a UFO presentation I gave in North Carolina in 1993. I asked her what she had learned from her father, now deceased. My memory of what Dad had to say was that he had met the gentleman who cared for the only remaining living being on the spaceship that crashed, near Roswell. Dad said that the fellow cried as he told him, because he missed the little one so much. He told Dad that it was like living with Jesus Christ. And he recounted that they didn't speak verbally, but telepathically, mind to mind. Dad remembered that he told him that the little man was so gentle and kind. Dad also remembered that he said the alien had only lived for 18 months, due to the atmospheric conditions and unacceptable food. Dad and this other Air Force officer, perhaps a lieutenant, met on an Air Force transport sometime during his stay in the service. Dad would have been in the Air Force Reserves.